Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. One of the things that fascinates me is how people start in their career. And we were talking about another friend of ours.
Right.
And you were telling me the story where you said to him, you're never going to be able to work for anyone. So maybe you can kind of start with your story in real estate, but also talk about how you figured out that you wanted to be an entrepreneur and not work for a real estate company and maybe be a partner in an already established firm?
It's a hell of a question to start with.
I'm going right at it. It's 8:30 in the morning. We're going out strong.
I love it. And the last week of the year, so we're running on fumes. Look, none of what I've done in my life has been by design. It's always been forks in the road. So yeah, I'm always humbled by what we've accomplished now because it's greater than anything I think I ever would have thought of as a kid. But it's a great question. When did I realize that I wanted to kind of captain my own ship? I was never great in school and kind of struggled through school. And between sophomore and junior year, was home in South Florida and had an internship. I got an internship with a fund of funds in Miami. And my mom got breast cancer over that summer. So my plans of going back to Gainesville, starting at University of Florida my junior year, because I didn't get in, I didn't have the grades to get in, so I had to go to community college first. And it got into University of Florida. My plan was do a summer internship, go back. My mom got breast cancer. Fortunately, she's fine and healthy now. But my brother was older. He was in graduate school in Dallas. My dad and stepmom lived in Texas. So I didn't even think about it. It was like, I'm just not going back to Gainesville. The internship became a job. So worked full time for a great family here in Miami and went to school at night and literally like missed that whole back half of the college experience, the big college experience. But I'd always worked. Like I'd always worked since I was 11 years old. I always wanted to work. So that's just something that's in my DNA in terms of work ethic where, you know, 9 to 5 doesn't make sense to me. That's like a third or half of a day. And I worked for this great family, and it was a family business. It was 4 siblings, and the father kind of sat above all of it. And they gave me great experience for those two and a half years or so. I got a firsthand seat when I took the job initially. You know, they didn't realize I was leaving after the summer initially. They thought they hired me as a job and then I was just going to bail after the summer. And when I took the job, when I had the interview, the president, the guy I interviewed with, he and I hit it off right away. And that's a telltale in a lot of things that have happened in my life, just meeting the right people, connecting with people, and that kind of, you know, helps drive some of the forks in the road. But said, hey, I'll come to work for you. He said the pay is between 28 and 32 grand. And I said, I'll show up on Monday for 32 grand under one condition, that once a week, no matter where you are, because he traveled a lot, I get an hour with you just to pick your brain, to learn. Because I always knew that you learn more from that than in school. And he was great. He gave me that visibility. But after being there for two and a half years and having that opportunity and helping create value in their business, I presented for my year-end comp because I was then, you know, like 21 years old and I was making 32 grand a year and I had helped create a lot of revenue for the business. And basically the response was like, you know, nothing. It was like, we'll give you a couple grand. And while I was still in school, I got offered a job to go work for a hedge fund in New York because they always thought I was older and I would go to these conferences before I was 21 and I'd have a fake ID. And I tell people I was 5 years older. And when they did that, that kind of reminded me of something that happened as a kid because my dad was a salesman for this medical consulting company. And he outsold the other 10 salespeople on the team. And we grew up middle class and he started making a really good living based on his comp schedule and residuals and whatnot. And they decided he was making too much money. One year they just decided he was making too much money. And completely fucked him, like literally completely changed his whole plan in terms of financial planning. And I remember him saying then, and I was a kid, but I remember him saying like, you always take care of the people that create value. You can never make that guy or gal happy enough because you never want to leave. They're making money for you as a business. And I'd presented that exact way, which is here's what I've made for the business. Here's the value I've created. And I think I should be paid commensurately, even though I'm only 21 years old. And their response was basically like, no. So I think that was a defining moment where I realized, hey, if I want to make a lot of money, I'm going to have to do it on my own. And basically told them on the spot, they'd had a yacht. I'm not going to name the yacht, but I said, hey, I helped basically pay for that boat, but you guys are just not, you're not mentors. Meaning in a family business, you hit a ceiling, you know, you're never going to get paid. So really, I think that was the moment that I said, hey, I'm not going to work for someone else. I kind of bounced around for a while there, just kind of doing some consulting jobs. People knew me. They'd hire me to do diligence on stuff. I just kind of bounced around and until I figured out what I wanted to do. I'm still figuring that out to some extent.
What was attractive about real estate versus hedge funds or other more technical math type things, which is kind of interesting coming from someone who almost didn't finish college.
Barely got through high school.
Yeah.
So I've always been fascinated with math. Like literally as a kid and even on my SATs, you know, I was 99th percentile in math, but bottom quartile in everything else. And it always interested me. I was calculating my dad's commission checks when I was 7. Like literally, I always had a thing for math. So having that experience on the, you know, and even in high school, I would skip school on Fridays, not to go smoke dope or hang out at the beach, but to watch Power Lunch on CNBC, because that's when they had a CEO on at the time. Now I think they do it every day. But I was basically buying and selling stocks in high school with my bar mitzvah money. Like we started this conversation talking about kids and their bar mitzvahs. I had like 8 grand for my bar mitzvah. And when I was 15, I got the statement from Morgan Stanley. I was like 6 grand. I'm like, dad, like what the hell? Like, you know, we had a neighbor that was a financial planner. And I'm like, can I invest some money? He goes, you can invest, you just can't spend it. So I became fascinated with, you know, public markets and how companies make money, and was always fascinated by that. And that money, which the first stock I bought was Lucent Technologies, and that split and split again.
Yep.
That money kind of, and you know, compounded and helped pay my way through college and whatnot. But I was always fascinated with math and finance, always from when I was a little kid. So being in that fund of funds and having that exposure to all these different managers and all these different ways that these guys have strategies to make returns and to make money always did fascinate me and still does. And in our business, you and I, in dealing with a lot of investors from different walks of life and backgrounds, to this day, it's still what fascinates me the most, which is how people create wealth through so many different avenues, whether it's real estate or manufacturing or some of the craziest things that we see in here today. We're like, how do you actually create so much wealth from that? So I wasn't driven or focused on, oh, I want to go down the hedge fund path at all. It was purely financial. I mean, there was no strategy to it whatsoever. And when I got hired, because I'd done a lot of work with the institutions then, you know, folks would hire me like, hey, we're trying to get financing. You know, can you help us put the package together, do some due diligence? So I was kind of a hired gun at 23 years old and got to move around and got to travel, which kind of accelerated my travel bug. And, you know, started working on some real estate deals, and guys were coming out, you know, saying, hey, you know, do you know this guy? He needs a bridge loan. Do you know anyone for it? So really just it was purely organic. It was not by design. And when I was 24, I convinced one high net worth individual to back me in a bridge lending business. Initially starting just like, hey, let's make a couple loans together. And it morphed into a real business that we scaled from 2004 to 2008. When I was 26, I made my first $1 million. When I was 27, I gave it all back in 2007 and really cut my teeth the hard way, meaning became a distress guy and a workout guy, literally by default. And that's how, again, the plan wasn't to be in development or doing what we now do at BH3. It was these kind of forks in the road. You know, had my mom not gotten breast cancer, you know, maybe I just would have gone back to the University of Florida and become, you know, a partner at Pricewaterhouse, you know, for all I know. But it was just these pivots along the way, and none of it by design.
Going back to your first job, what did you learn or what did you see there that stuck with you that was not going to be the way that you were going to invest or run a business that you said, wow, that was great. I saw that there, but I'm not going to do it that way.
It's a great question. Look, I think how we run BH3, and when I say we, my partners and I, we built the whole business on relationships, and our people, our team is what makes us. And we try and take really good care of them. It was really humbling. The other night we had our holiday party and we had all 29 people from our Florida, Denver, New York office. We have one lady in Philadelphia as well. Everyone was in town for the first time. Everyone was in the office, which had never happened before. And we had our holiday lunch. It was really amazing. Kind of like as I'm standing there with my partner saying, you know, holy shit, you know, it's a family to us and we've created something amazing and it's only going to continue to grow in the right way. And it's investing in great people and having that team that shares that vision and working alongside them. I think that we've hardly in the 15-year history of the firm, hardly had anyone leave, meaning no one's left us for really a better opportunity. There's been two people along the way where the job description had outgrown their role and we helped them, you know, or encouraged them to move to other positions. But it can't happen without great people and surrounding yourself with great people, you know, that entrust you and share the vision, I think is paramount. And taking care of those people that help drive revenue for the business. You know, not making the same mistake that the company my dad worked for made.
How do you figure out if someone's great? Because I think a lot of people that start a company maybe outgrow some of the initial people that were there. Maybe there's some C players, some B players that kind of linger on. But how do you identify those A players in your business?
Look, it's a constant evolution. If you're growing, if your business is growing, it's a challenge because you have an affinity for people that, you know, you like as human beings, and they're great people. And sometimes as the company evolves and grows, you've just moved on, meaning they haven't kept up with that pace of growth and evolution, whether it's technology. I mean, we had a guy that was with us forever in New York, an amazing human being. I love him and adore him and his family. But as we just evolved, even on things like SharePoint and file organization and just organizational stuff that had to, as we, in order to grow, we were too big to be small and too small to be big, and we had to move forward. And he was just archaic and refused to evolve. And it reached a point where it just created so much discontent with other people on the team that he was working with and disorganization that it came to a head. And it was voluntary on his part, but it came to a head where it's like, hey, we've got to move on. You know, the train has left the station and you have to keep up. And sometimes it's unfortunate because you have great people that you did a great job, and it wasn't because they weren't good at their job. It's because there's evolution and the job description changes. But it's a constant challenge. It really is a constant challenge. Everyone thinks that owning and running a business is glamorous. There's a lot of hard decisions and hard conversations that come along with it that, you know, result in a lot of sleepless nights.
In a private equity real estate firm like yours, what's the best way to comp people, to take care of people?
Yeah, it's always a struggle because the metrics are all over the place. You have folks on different teams that have different contributions. And the reality is it's another issue of being an owner of a business, is that alignment of expectations is always challenging. What we actually started doing a few years back is forcing everyone to do self-reviews and for them to basically say, here's what I think my bonus should be. Because there were prior years where we sat down and we gave bonuses and we thought like, oh my God, like this is, these, they're going to be ecstatic, and they were disappointed. And so I think a lot of it, and as entrepreneurs and deal guys, we're always too focused on the deals and running the business that the communication part is something that we're not always the best at.
Yep.
In terms of sitting down and saying, okay, this is what your expectation is. Here's what you need to do to get there. Here's, you know, where we think you can improve. Here's where we think you're not allocating time properly. And historically, we're just, as the founders, we're not great at that. Just it's not one of our strengths. So several years ago, we hired a great COO, and she's amazing. And she kind of, you know, makes sure that the communication both ways is there. But it's really, really challenging. You know, we have scorecards that we do on a deal level basis where we're giving points of promote in deals. We're giving carry in certain structures. Certain folks, it's just a percentage of their salary, depending on their function, like in the back office and in finance and accounting. And then for our executive team, we just went through a whole restructuring where they actually have, you know, vested interest in the company in the event it's ever sold. So aligning incentives is always really challenging. And we're sitting here, it's December 19th. We're going through all of this right now, and it's the least enjoyable part of the year. It's enjoyable from the sense of you get the opportunity to tell people, which we don't often get to do enough, and we're doing it more regularly, how much you appreciate them. But it also, if you're doing it right, it forces uncomfortable conversations with, you know, giving constructive criticism.
The benefit of a growing company is that you have the flexibility to change your structures. You know, you're not like a Blackstone where it's so big and you kind of have to be set in your ways after a certain period because you've done it so long. That's also the challenge that we have, because we can change and adjust, and you might find that one year this worked well, and then you do a deal and maybe there was no comp or the comp was too small, and then you feel an obligation to change it a little bit. How do you think you are wooing potential team members from these big firms to your firm? Like, what is the reason they come work for BH3?
First part is you're 100% right. Everyone thinks there's kind of this one size fits all solution. And if you're selling widgets, I guess that works. But when you have different verticals, you know, we're in performing and non-performing debt, we're in opportunistic equity, we're in ground up development, we're in growth equity, and all these have different durations, different outcomes, and different comp structures for us as a firm, right? So you try and find this approach, and then you iterate off of it. And again, every deal is different that we do. So it's like, oh, that's what we thought when we came up with this. But in this particular scenario where it was non-performing, it became reperforming, and then we sold it in 7 months and we didn't get paid how we thought we'd get paid, you know, that shouldn't apply the same way. In terms of how we attract talent, I'd be lying if I said it was by design. Meaning in how we do it today in terms of recruiting new people. How we do it is from 15 years of just organic creation of this culture and reputation. We were interviewing someone last week from New York. We flew him down and he asked us, if you look at your peer set, who do you want to comp yourself to? And it was a great question that no one had ever asked us. And it was at a dinner with me and my two partners, and all of us kind of paused for a real, you know, what felt like 5 minutes, was probably 20 seconds. And then I said, there isn't one, meaning we've kind of created our own path and our own culture. And yeah, I'm sure there's certain things that you'd say, oh, we'd like to, you know, have that piece of Rialto and this piece of Starwood. But the reality is what we've created is just who we are in terms of BH3. And people gravitate towards that, meaning we've had a great experience of attracting great talent from those big shops, not because we're reaching out to them. They're coming to us and saying, hey, you know what? I want to be somewhere that's more entrepreneurial. I want to be somewhere I can make more of a direct impact. I want to be part of growing something. And when they spend time with us and they see what we have in our office and in our offices, they gravitate towards it. We're really fortunate in that sense that, you know, what we've created is magnetic in a sense.
I want to talk about BH3 for a little bit because we kind of like glossed over what you're doing and what you're up to. But maybe you can speak about it in the context of how entrepreneurial you are. I was having a conversation yesterday with someone because we're raising a new fund, and right. I have an interest in potentially diversifying a little bit out of hospitality into one specific asset class or maybe various asset classes, but solely in Florida. And they said, well, are you going to do that in your new fund? And I'm like, no, because I think you need to be very focused when you're dealing with some of these bigger family offices and institutions in terms of what your strategy is. But you've kind of figured out to be both entrepreneurial and institutional because, you know, you're going to go into it, but you're a developer, you're a debt fund, you're a regular private equity fund. You've got a lot going on. And do you get a lot of objections to that? That like, hey, wait a second, you guys are too big to be going in 10 different directions.
Yeah. So BH3, the way BH3 is set up is we basically have three business lines. One is ground up development. And what also falls in there is opportunistic equity, where, you know, we'll buy something if, you know, it's usually where we're between the wall and the wallpaper. It's a structure. It's a unique situation like Icon Los Olos, where it can buy out another private equity partner. So that's kind of the equity side of the business, which is all SPVs, deal by deal, no fund or committed capital, and no plans of going the committed capital route there as general partners, as GPs. And we don't think that that's a great fund business for what we do because we're very selective on the development side and there's ebbs and flows there. And it's really a timing-based business. The credit side of the business, which the DNA of the firm started in just stress in 2009, the evolution of the firm was, you know, two guys, my partner, Dan Levins, and I came together to do a deal, not to build a firm. And 15 years later, we've, you know, deployed over $2 billion of equity capital, again, debt, development, opportunistic equity. but the evolution of the firm until 2018 was all SPVs, even on the debt stuff. So 2009, 2012, a lot of distress, institutional capital. We didn't have a track record, don't come from money. We were able to convince MSD Capital to back us on our first deal and King Street to back us on our third deal, and did a lot of damage during that window, 2009, 2012, predominantly in Florida and New York, and really fell into the ground up development business in 2013. Because we had taken over other people's projects, finished construction, built up this kind of internal development team, and then fell headfirst into the development business where we did Purvey, which, you know, out of the gate was 1.3 million gross square feet on an 8-acre island, highly contested, wildly successful project. And that development business has continued to scale between here and New York, you know, delivered over 4 million square feet, another few million square feet on the pad. But we never appreciated until 2018 the kind of the concentric circle where our skill sets that have been developed from inception in 2009 to 2018 of, you know, in a world where there's credit guys that sit behind a screen that know credit, there's a cohort of folks that know how to build or to run into, you know, or to fix things or to renovate. And then there's a smaller cohort of distressed guys that have, you know, been battle tested and have the scars to prove it, of distress and complex litigation, federal, state level. And we kind of are unique in the sense that we're that concentric circle. So when you look at our three business units, they're all synergistic, meaning on the credit side of the business, the development and construction team is heavily involved. You know, from an underwriting standpoint, from a data standpoint, those two businesses were seeing deal flow, credit side in real time where, you know, borrowers are buying out trades. We're seeing on the development side, we're able to coalesce that. We're able to see a deal, an inbound deal on the credit side, and within 30 minutes, basically revise that borrower's pro forma to real time because we have better data than they do. So they're completely synergistic. And the growth equity side of the business, which is there to really invest strategically in operating businesses tied to real estate construction, are where we're customers. Generally speaking, it's where we're customers. You know, whether it's software, whether it's materials, whether it's specialty subs, it's where we believe that, hey, we're customers first. You remember the old hair club for men? And that we and our partners and our peers and our institutional partners are our reach of people that we can actually add value to that business by being not only a customer, but bringing other customers. So all of it is synergistic. And when we walk investors through that and double click on it, it makes sense for them. They understand actually that is our special sauce, that on the credit side, we're more equipped and we have better ammunition than most of the debt funds do, which come to us on a local level and say, hey, we're looking at this deal, because they know that we have that expertise. So from our standpoint, and again, we didn't realize how much this coalesced really until 2018. Again, not planned.
So let's talk about the development side first. And I want to talk about Privet, because you'll explain the deal and explain how that whole thing happened. But as I understand it, you took over the project in a distressed capacity and then somehow was like, well, you know, fuck it, we'll just develop it. And this is a massive condo project. So let's hear about Privet, because when I think about you guys, that's definitely one of the defining deals, I think, in your career that allowed you to complete that concentric circle and be more than just a developer or a credit group or a distress group.
1,000%. As our partner on Privet said, that one will put you on the map. So it was not a distress scenario at all, actually. And it goes back to building relationships and people. So in January 2013, I got a phone call from a mutual friend, and my partner Daniel, in the same week, got a phone call from one of our attorneys. Both said, do you know Gary Cohen? And do you know that island that sits in the middle of the Intracoastal, just south of the Lehman Causeway? And I said, I don't know Gary, but I've seen that island and, you know, known it's there, but I've never been on it. And they connected me with Gary that same day. And I literally went out to the island, met him. And Gary, whose father had really created Aventura, meaning they dredged and filled all of that property, really from Williams Island to Biscayne Boulevard. So Sofer was on the north side of Lehman Causeway. Norman Cohn was on the south side. He came into that as a distressed deal originally.
Wow.
And then actually bought these two spoil islands from Sofer out of bankruptcy initially during the oil crisis, I think. There's no bridges connecting them. The original thought was there would be gambling coming to Miami. We'll run ferry boats to the motels on Sunny Isles. And Gary, after his father had passed, then spent, you know, a decade plus getting the bridges, built the first island as homes, and had a plan for the second island and had several different iterations of that plan, but recognized that he wasn't equipped, didn't have the horsepower to do it himself, need a partner, but is an amazing, amazingly smart developer, but just didn't have the infrastructure and wanted a partner, a true partner, not someone, not one of the big guys that's just going to come in and push him to the side. So we met, we hit it off. I walked the island with him. We went back to his office. He showed me the plans that he had, which were drawn up by Seeger Suarez. And Seeger Suarez was the architect, developer, and GC on Terra Beach side. Our first deal that we did as a firm, where we worked hand-in-hand.
What year was that?
That was 2009.
Okay.
So that, and again, this goes back to relationships. They were our they were the borrower on a defaulted loan that we bought from Regions Bank, where we were foreclosing, taking over their baby and their project and finishing it. And basically, they just needed to get off their completion guarantees, but they lost a lot of money on that deal. And we did it in a way, and this is just our MO, and did it the same way with Related on Trump Hollywood, where there's just no egos. Like we don't care about the limelight. We don't care about ego. We're not looking to, you know, pound our chest and say that, you know, we achieve victory. We just want to do good deals. And I'd spent a year or a year and a half working with them before we were able to buy that deal. We knew it was a deal. This is in the depths of the GFC. And said, hey, it's your baby. We're going to reset the capital stack. You're going to show up to work every day. We're going to pay you. We're going to burn off your guarantees. And then we're going to figure out how to do other stuff together. So fast forward to 2013. And we can write a book, and we'll write a book on that Terra Beach side deal one day. This distress of all distress deals.
We should talk about that one too.
We can. But back to Gary Cohen, he takes out the plans, says Seeger Suarez, and it's this Mediterranean 90s looking product. And I said to Gary, I said, Gary, if we're going to have any chance of being partners, it starts with brutal honesty. This has to go in the garbage. You know, let's call Charlie Seeger right now. So I called Charlie Seeger and put him on speaker. And I said, Charlie, it's Greg. I'm sitting here with Gary Cohen. And he says, please tell me you're coming into the deal in Aventura. And I said, yeah, you know, we just met, but I'm looking at these plans and kind of like, what the fuck? And he says, look at the guy next to you. One of the smartest, most brilliant people you will ever meet. The most amazing partner you can ever have. But he needs a partner that has vision, meaning his vision for that was what he had done for the homes on the first island. And the market had just changed, right? And it was a style that was not his personal style, meaning contemporary is not his personal style. And Charlie said, I'm on my way over. And he came over literally, and he says, this is what it should be. It should be Apogee, you know, it should look like Apogee South Beach, but we're going to curve it with the island, and we're going to lean the building out as it goes over. And literally that sketch, by and large, is what Purvey is. It's, you know, two twin towers. And I went back to my office and I said to my partners, I said, we're going into the ground up development business. And they said, what are you talking about? And I said, we're going into the ground up development business. You gotta see this property. Cause when you walked onto this island, you couldn't see the other side of it. It was like, it was incredible. So we all got together with Gary and we went out to the island, and on the island, we said, we're going into the ground up development business, and literally penned a deal term sheet with Gary within a few weeks. We had at the time Grove Isle under contract, and
Grove Isle in Key Biscayne.
Coconut Grove. And we have a penchant. We're attracted towards complex deals, right? Cause that's where we feel we can create value. And one of our trusted attorneys said, look, Grove Isle, you have the two best sites, arguably, in South Florida to develop. Grovyle is going to be a real challenge. You're going to have real opposition. There's folks on that island that are incredibly, you know, connected politically and powerful. Go do Purvey. It's clean. It's vested. It's entitled. There's no issues there. So we actually drop Grovyle and we move forward with Purvey. And literally 60 days later, while we were negotiating our JV agreement, I think our JV agreement hadn't even been done yet or had just been done, Williams Island filed their lawsuit. And Gary calls us and says, well, guys, you know, I guess we'll put pens down on this. And, you know, I got to go fight this. This will be over quickly. You know, it's complete bullshit. You know, the development rights are vested. We could actually do twice as much development as we planned. So let me go fight this and kind of we'll come back to the JV later. And we said, Gary, that's not what partnership is. Like, we're here, you know, we diligence this. We know that it's bullshit. You know, we're in this together. And literally that went on for 4 years. I mean, we were in that litigation for 4 years and we were selling and building throughout it. And it was, there were many, many sleepless nights because we had a bad judge early on that didn't understand statute of limitations and vested rights. He was a family attorney handling a complex real estate deal. So it was distressed. It wasn't distressed when we came into it. It was distress for a period of time where we were just fighting for our economic livelihoods and they were trying to take it all from an optics standpoint, never from a merit standpoint. They never got the zoning opinion because no firm would give it to them, but they played the system and they played it well. But after 4 years, it was thrown out on our counterclaims, unanimous jury verdict, multi eight figure judgment of which they paid us 90% of within 2 weeks after the judgment. But it was a battle, and you talk about great partnerships. In those 4 years, Daniel, myself, and Gary experienced 100 years of partnership because you're in battle, and true partnerships, you don't know if they're real, if they're good, great, or terrible until you actually have a challenge. And this was a challenge of all challenges. And we all aged many, many years. Many more than 4 years during that period of time. I think it made us stronger, certainly smarter, more pessimistic. But yeah, that partnership was forged and Gary's gone on to be an investor partner with us on other deals. And we're looking at going back in Aventura now and doing something together.
Was Privé successful?
It was incredibly successful. I mean, we were in a fortunate place where in spite of the litigation, and again, you understand and appreciate this, and no matter how smart you are, how great you are at execution, timing and luck play a role
huge
in outcomes, and it's never on the spreadsheet, right? Performance is always wrong. And from a timing standpoint, during that litigation, pricing went up, but our costs had been locked in on 2014 numbers. So the ultimate margin on that deal was significant. Our cost of capital was tremendous because no one wanted to touch. Every institutional group, every debt fund loved the deal. We had the sales, those low leverage construction loan, and they just couldn't get there on the PR risk. We literally ended up syndicating, you know, through our partners, our friends at Max, we ended up syndicating our construction loan because the PR risk was too great for real groups that knew there was no merit.
Was it the PR risk or the risk of potential litigation that just don't want to take on the risk?
It was all the headlines. I mean, it's analogous to, from a PR standpoint, the kind of the Israel Hamas thing to an extent. Hamas has a much better PR engine. They're terrorists. Our opposition here were terrorists. They knew.
Well, people literally got arrested, as I recall.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Prefer not to go down that path. But they knew. It started from stick up value. They wanted to stick us up for some legacy things back on Williams Island, and they were very upfront about it. They basically, you know, initially said, "You know, give us X, and you know, we'll go away." And we basically told them to pound sand. but they were terrorists and they knew it, and they knew they didn't have a case with merit, and they just wanted to, you know, manipulate the system and manipulate the optics to try and make our lives brutal. And the reality is that, you know, in hindsight, when we designed this project, what we're allowed to build there is literally double the height and double the density. And it would look like Peninsula 1 and 2 over there. And we said, hey, you know, we don't want to do that. We have this amazing island. We want to do something that's timeless. We're going to get the highest price of anything ever in Aventura because we're not on the mainland, and less is more. Let's do something really unique. Thinking that when we came out with that, again, we didn't need approvals from anyone, that it would be so well received. And in hindsight, what we should have done, taking a playbook from other developers, is come out with Peninsula 1 and 2. And when everyone screamed bloody murder, say, okay, you know, open up the other side of the trench. You know, what about this? And that being purveyed, and they would have been like, oh my God, this is amazing. Because it is recognized as one of the greatest developments in South Florida. When you go there today, I went last week, I hadn't been in a long time, it's spectacular. I mean, it's something that you can't replicate is nearly impossible to replicate.
Can you break down condo development in South Florida for people? Because I didn't understand how the game fully works until recently. And I don't think there's any other market, maybe New York, where condos and people are so prevalent and people have gotten so rich building condos. So, like, can you talk through the capital structure and how these things work? Sure. And how the big developers play it?
Sure. First off, the condo business, I hate using the term because it's so institutional, but the condo business is binary, meaning you never will meet a condo developer that says, yeah, I did okay on that one. They either kill it or they get killed. And a lot of that depends on timing. Now, our condo structure here in South Florida, coming out of the GFC, morphed into what it still is today in some iteration, which is entirely unique relative to the balance of the country. It's more reflective of a Latin American model where buyers are putting up big deposits. But what happened, the evolution of that is, you know, if you have that line of demarcation, call it pre-2012, yeah, and part of the GFC and some of the stuff we took over, the old way of doing it was people put up 10% deposits or 20% deposits. And that created, during the bull market pre-GFC, created a tremendous amount of speculation. People were buying up, you know, multiple condos, just putting 10%, having deferred closings. They were flipping contracts. And at 10%, the analogy I always use is, at a 10% deposit or 20% deposit, you're buying an option, right? You're not buying the actual stock. You're buying an option. You're being speculative, which is fine, but that's what it is and called for what it is. So what happened is all of that product that was announced in 2006 and early 2007 that got delivered in 2009, 2010, no one closed, right? Meaning there were people flipping their contracts, but when the music stopped and the guy was still standing and not in the chair, it was like, okay, now it's your time to close. They just walked, right? So Trump Hollywood, when we took over that job, the building had been delivered in January 2010. 200 units, over 600,000 square feet of net sellable, 20 people closed.
Wow.
So there's 180 units that people had bought at one price that just said, we're not closing. That was it. So the evolution would evolve from that. So that old model was not what it was today. Condo developers did not make the kind of multiples or returns then that they're making now, if they hit it right and timing and execution is right. But what evolved from that, and George and Related were the first and are generally the visionaries in this stuff, is they said, hey, we're going to use the Latin model. It's 50% deposits. You're no longer buying an option. You're buying the stock. And everyone thought it was crazy at first, but it was accepted. It was accepted because at the time, the demographic buying was purely or primarily Latin from Central and South America. And it was not abnormal to them. So when they accepted it, everyone else, you know, domestically kind of, they would come in and say, oh, I want to buy a unit. They say it's 50% deposit. They say, what are you talking about? Everyone else is doing it. You know, why not? So the impact of that, which will lead to probably one of your other questions about where you think the market is, is that it rejiggered the whole capital stack. The buyers were now taking real risk. The developer had more insularity and would still put in equity, but perhaps not have to raise or put in as much equity. And most importantly, the senior construction lender was super low leverage. And that composition of that capital stack is largely similar today, or the same today. The deposits have moved down from 50% to 30 to 40%, depending on the market. But that is enabled because those deposits are usable, right? You're allowed.
What does that mean?
Meaning those buyer deposits, if a buyer buys $1 million unit and puts up a 50% deposit, 500 grand, the first 10% or 100 grand has to stay in escrow, can't be used. The other 400 grand, you as the developer are allowed to use for permit expenses, which is really just hard calls for construction. You can't use it for financing or commissions or anything like that. And then what certain developers will do is they'll go bond over that first 100 grand and they'll be able to use that as well. We've never done that, but it's calm. It's not abnormal.
What does that mean?
Meaning a surety will say, oh, that buyer is going to close. They put up a 50% deposit. So we'll basically release, or we'll bond over and lend you that first 10% at a cheaper cost of capital so you can go use that, because that buyer is going to show up and close and we know that you'll get that money. So the return profile for condo developers, if they execute properly with a good timing and a little bit of luck, the multiples became outsized because the cost of capital for using that buyer's deposit is zero. By the way, today it's actually a negative cost of capital because that money would sit in an interest-bearing account.
Yep.
But rates were zero back in the day. They wouldn't pay you anything in escrow. Now there's actually a yield on that. So it is a great business. What's happened, there used to be a larger spread between, you know, costs and sellout. Your costs have obviously run up significantly. So margins have been compressing, even though prices have gone up. It's the same thing in multifamily as well. You know, rents ran up, but so did everything else. Taxes, labor, insurance is through the roof. So there hasn't been real margin improvement in any of those businesses. There was this kind of nice pop early days in the model, but now it's par for the course of getting to a good regular condo margin.
Is it potentially possible, I like that, potentially possible, that one of these big condo developers that we all know developing a $300 or $400 million project may only need to put up $10-20 million of equity because they're leveraging the deposits and other forms of financing in order to get the building built?
Well, I think it depends. The answer is it's possible. Nothing's impossible in the world of real estate and capital stacks, as we've seen throughout cycles. But it depends. I guess it depends on the evolution of that deal. How long have they owned the land? Does the owner of the land just contribute it into the JV without them having to close on it? What is that land worth? Did they upzone it? Did they get entitlements? How much equity are they actually putting in? And that number is fungible. And it's really fungible because getting to that point of baking that project, meaning getting those pre-sales and having that capital stack be in that place, takes real pursuit costs, right? So even if they were given the land for free, which doesn't happen, in order to get to that point, they need to build a sales center. They need to do marketing. They need to get a brand. If they're doing brand, they need to spend millions and millions of dollars creating this narrative and proof of concept and proof of life. And then they have to pay partial commissions at contract signing. So just those pursuit costs to flush out, hey, is our timing right? Is our product right? Is our price right? Is a real risk on speculative investment, because if you're wrong, it's a zero.
Yep.
And we've seen many instances of people try and launch projects throughout time and they just never got out of the gate, or they spent a lot of time and money and just never got there. So I know I'm not answering your question. It's possible, but the condo business is a risk on business. And you're doing that because the multiples that you're supposed to achieve on a deal level or on a GP level are outsized and commensurate with that risk on the one hand, but what people also forget and don't realize is, you know, you see these condo developers and you say, oh, they crush it, they made a ton of money. Well, you know, and you can even use Purvey as an example. You know, we started that deal in 2013, right? When we first walked on the island, delivered the job in end of 17 and early 18. Tower one was end of 17, tower two was end of 18. Had some inventory left. COVID came in early 2020, sold our remnant units in 2021. We turned over the association in 2019, I believe. And in the condo world, once you turn over, basically they hire engineers and then they come back and tell you everything that's wrong with the building. And you end up what's called a 558 claim process. So they basically file their report and it takes years to navigate through that. Now, as a developer, you have insurance, you have contractors, you have subcontractors, you have bonds. As a developer, you're really kind of like the mediator in between, meaning you're not, certainly not on the side of the contractor, you're on the side of the buyers, and you're trying to have everything remediated and then settled out at some point. But that takes 7 years sometimes. The latent defect, the statute of repose for latent defects was 10 years. It got reduced to 7. So when so we're still dealing with that to some extent. So when you amortize, you make all your money in 1 year, but when you amortize over the actual life cycle of that development, in most instances, you're underpaid for the level of risk that you're taking.
You got to keep the game going. Like, looking back on it, what mistakes did you make, or what was the biggest mistake you made on Privé that if you were to do another massive ground up project like that, a ground up condo development, that you would do differently?
Oh, that's a great question. We thought that we did, because we're good guys and it's how we run our businesses, it's how we run our lives, we thought we did everything right there. In hindsight, we were too nice about it initially, until our backs were against the wall and when we had to fight. Because we don't shy away from a fight, but it's like, you know, when you're a kid, your dad said, don't start a fight, but if you get in a fight, finish it, right? You know, I think that we were too, not apoplectic, but that we were just too nice about it initially. And that, you know, if I could go back and change anything on Purvey, it would be to come out initially with something that offended people. Meaning not actually offended them, but something that was as of right, that was big and imposing, and that is reflective of what sits on the other side of the water, that was built to max density. And by the way, most developers, ourselves included in other instances, when we're looking at a site, all we're focusing on is how can I max this out? What is my max FAR? What's my max net leasable or sellable? And how do I squeeze every inch? Because every foot has real tangible value. We're fortunate on Purvey to not have to do that because of our partner. And that was important to him, having such a history in Aventura, that to leave this as his legacy, that it wasn't about maxing it out. And in hindsight, if we would go back and change one thing, I think Gary and Daniel would say this as well, is that our one error would be that we should have initially come out with two really big towers. And perhaps that the feedback from that would have then welcomed what was designed as Purvey. But I wouldn't trade that experience that we went through for anything in the world. Meaning, I basically got a law degree. We paid a lot of money for it, but you know, being in the trenches with my partners, going through that, there are days you want to pull your hair out, but I would not trade that experience for anything. Just like going through the GFC, you know, when I built my business, you know, in pivoting the BH3, that interim period, you know, getting punched in the head every day, you know, with defaults in the loan portfolio, you hate it at the time, but when you come out on the other side of it and you recognize that you're stronger and smarter as a result, that experience and how we won there is more valuable to us as people and as a business, as a firm, and to our grit and our tenacity, and it's a real part of our story. You know, people it was a very public, not because we wanted it to be, it was a very public fight. And people, I think, respect that, that hey, we knew we were right. You stand on principles. And in our world, in our business, you're often forced with that debate because there's a lot of frivolous litigation is part of the real estate business. But your attorneys will come to you and say, hey, yeah, there's this bullshit claim. It'll cost you $500,000. You're right. We'll win. It's going to cost you $500,000 to prove that you're right. Or you can make it go away for $50,000. But that one, we didn't have a choice on sticking to our principles. It was literally fighting for our economic lives.
I guess here's the question. So coming out of Privé, given how public it was and how great of a job you did and what the building looked like and the challenges that you faced, you probably could have propelled a very significant condo development business across South Florida. What was it about the time and the opportunity coming out of Privé that maybe you didn't think that was such a good opportunity, or the opportunities weren't there at the time for you to kind of go all in on just be a condo developer?
Yeah. It's a great question. It wasn't without thought. So it actually translates into how we started our first debt fund in 2018. You know, we were, because it was such an intense battle during that period of time, we really had blinders on. There wasn't much capacity as a firm to focus on much other opportunity in that 2014 to, you know, 2018 period. There just wasn't. Yeah, there wasn't the time, number one, but the emotional, you know, space didn't exist. It was just draining. So we certainly missed some opportunity as a result of that. Now, again, wouldn't trade that. Privé was wildly successful, and it's been a stepping stone to do a lot of other things that the firm is doing. But coming into 2018, we actually felt, in hindsight, we were wrong and we were early, but we actually felt that the equity bid was a bit frothy, meaning we were looking at opportunities. We continued transacting opportunistically into 2019, again, on structural things like Icon Los Olas, where, you know, not on the market, you know, there's a story, there's a partner, but we thought that things were frothy. We thought that 2019 would be a challenging year. We thought that rates would move, and we thought that there was distress around the corner. And in 2018, what we did in kind of, you know, real strategizing for the firm, because Dan and I initially had a third partner, Charlie Phelan. In 2017, we bought him out just because Dan and I had plans on growing the firm, reinvesting in people, and Charlie wanted to slow down, spend more time with his family, loves fishing, you know, amazing guy, but just kind of, we were going in a different trajectory. And as part of that, in 2018, we said, hey, we're going to double down on investing in great people, because adding people to the team is not a cost, it's an investment. And we now have a track record, which we didn't have. And we have the ability to raise capital, which we didn't really have in 2009. And we should have committed capital around a debt strategy, because that's our DNA. And we think there's distress coming around the corner. And that's really what formulated the investment thesis and the investment strategy for Beatrice's debt opportunity funds. Same strategy in fund one applies in fund two, just different time in the market, which is, we know distress. We know how to buy broken capital stacks. We know how to, if we get to the asset, we have the team to go in and fix it, finish it, reposition it. But what we also have is this great experience of investing throughout the entirety of the capital stack and structure and capital markets. And we and our investors like yield just as much as anyone else. So how do we come up with a strategy where we don't want to necessarily position ourselves as originators that we're out there trying to compete with our friends in the debt fund business, but how do we do it where we're strategic to them? Because in our view, in our geographies, we have better data, we have better relationships, we have better experience, expertise, whether it's the subs, whether it's the land use attorneys, whether it's knowing the sponsors, knowing nuances on deals, having real-time data on what things are costing, being able to be accretive actually as a counterparty versus just someone that has capital. So this thesis that we tested in 2018 was, hey, let's have a two-prong approach, performing and non-performing, and let's be good partners to the debt funds. And let's act as credit enhancement to them behind the curtain, where we participate with them on performing loans, but then we have visibility into their book and buying non-performing loans because we think that's around the corner. And we were early. I mean, Fund One still did great in a zero rate, non-stress environment. But Fund Two, what we're experiencing now in 2023 is what we thought to a different extent would have occurred in 2019.
How do you balance your whole mindset and approach to relationships and outwardly convince people, if you're on the performing side, that you're not just there to take their asset, because you do have experience in doing that and you do buy non-performing loans?
Yeah. So I think if you look at our experience over 15 years, and as a firm, we've done over 100 credit deals. We've, in terms of like, the question is, you know, forcefully taking someone's asset, I can't count on one hand, meaning it doesn't take up more than one hand, the instances where that's actually occurred. In most instances, we're sitting with borrowers. We're not looking to be villains, and that's not a great way to build a business either. And we sit with borrowers in these situations, and there's generally two personalities of a borrower. It's either, hey, I recognize where I'm at. And a lot of times it's not an asset issue. It's a borrower issue. They have problems somewhere else. And let me work it out. Let me sell it. Let me bring in more equity capital. Let me bring in pref equity. Let me bring in a JV partner, or let me restructure this deal with you as the lender. That's one personality. And it's generally, in the world of commercial real estate, if they're sophisticated borrowers, that's generally the norm. But you do have this other subset of borrower mentality where they're just fighters and they're going to fight for the sake of fighting, and they don't care about logic. It's purely emotional. And the outcome is always the same there, which is they'll try and drag it through the mud, prolong the process, but they ultimately lose. And then at that foreclosure auction, either someone else is buying it or we're taking it back. Again, will not fill one hand in those instances. So much so that I told you about Seeger Suarez, right? They've gone on to be our architects on several of our jobs. Trump Hollywood was related group. We've been JV partners with them and co-investors with them. So you would think, oh, these guys, you know, took over an asset. It goes back to the ego comment, which is we're smart enough. First of all, we come from humble backgrounds, so we don't have egos. But as we became successful, again, surrounded by great relationships and mentors, you know, one of my guys always said, the only way to make a lot of money is your ego doesn't walk through the door. Like, you just leave it there. So it's being humble. And a lot of it, I mean, even on the non-performing stuff, the two non-performing deals we bought this year, we had the borrowers at our office. You know, this is not, we're not there to be cantankerous. So, and what borrowers are now seeing on the performing side, where we're not behind the curtain on some of these, where we're asked to be out front because they know we add value, is they see that we're creative to their process, because we've actually been through what they're going through. We've executed on that business plan. So you would think that they would be opposed to saying, oh, I don't want to borrow from a peer, someone that knows my business. But having gone through these experiences that most of them have, where they've borrowed from these big debt funds that actually don't know their business. They, in large part, they don't know the nuances of construction and development, how decisions need to be made. And that's been a hindrance to a lot of these borrowers. So I think they actually appreciate that we're sitting there and we're saying, hey, who's your drywall sub? Oh, you know what? That guy is just a new name for this other sub that went bankrupt on us and screwed us, right?
Sounds like every drywall sub in Miami, unfortunately, yeah.
So I think that, and we're not shy about it. We think that we add value and we're getting paid commensurate with that. Again, capital's ubiquitous. I think you need to have something different to bring to the table.
I want to unpack the performing side a little bit, because you're actually, to your point, strategic from the standpoint of your A-piece lender in your capital stack, but you're also strategic for the borrower in that that big debt fund that you were referring to, they probably won't go to a last dollar basis that you're willing to go to.
Right.
As an expert, as a local, as someone that's maybe willing to take on more risk. So can you kind of unpack for people who don't know how this world works, like where does your capital come from? How do you sit in the capital stack? How do you structure it with a whole note package? Like, how does that all look?
Sure. So let's start with how it works for most groups that are known by most people.
Yeah.
Behind the curtain. So all of your big debt funds and mortgage REITs that are in the business of making, you know, bridge, transition, or construction loans or special situations, most of them have facilities or credit facilities that are levered, you know, at pick the name of the bank, you know, JP Morgan, you know, a bunch of the regional banks are big providers of this. And they all kind of sit in this facility or this repo facility, and they're all commingled in there. And those are levered debt funds, and all of those deals are crossed. And if one of those deals becomes non-performing, they need to take it out of that facility. And there's all kinds of mechanisms there for mark to market and bunch of a whole stew with all of that portfolio sitting in there. So what that levered debt fund or mortgage REIT already does is they originate a whole loan. So they'll give a $100 million loan to a borrower, and totally behind the curtain, with no visibility to the borrower, they'll put that on their facility, repo or otherwise. And they'll put $65 million of that on their repo facility. Some will put $80 million on there, some will put $50. And basically their manufacturing or engineering, their return. So if they wrote that loan at, you know, whatever, at 10%, and they take two turns of leverage and their leverage costs them, you know, 7%, they're making 16 on their money because they're picking up that spread between 7 and 10, two times over on the leverage. So that's how they're getting and manufacturing their yields. So if you put that in a box for a second, those are groups that, not all, but most of which don't actually have development and construction expertise, have not been developers or owners or operators. They're purely capital providers. That's it. They hire a construction monitor. They're credit guys that largely sit behind a desk in an office. They'll come and do a site visit before they close the deal so that in their investment committee memo, they say, yeah, we actually went to the property, it exists. That's that business. And it's a real viable business that has only gained market share as non-traditional lenders have taken more space coming out of GFC from regulation, kind of creating this void that the banks left. And you're only seeing more of it now with the regionals having to pull back.
Yep.
So private credit is here to stay. It's part of the ecosystem. It's a necessity. And what they do is a very viable and valuable piece of our ecosystem in real estate. What we do is similar, but very different. In our fund, first off, we refuse and will not and legislate that we won't have fund level leverage, because we believe that having all deals crossed is not an optimal business plan in real estate where things always change. And being an owner, a developer, an operator, and folks that have literally have scars from going through it and exercising remedies, we have a different view of how, if something falls off the rails, how quickly it needs to be put back on the rails before it completely goes off. And that's kind of the job that we serve as a good partner to a lot of these debt funds, is that if they're originating a performing loan, we're happy to be behind the curtain. Again, no egos about it. We're helping them first stay away from deals they shouldn't be doing from our knowledge and our data and our experience. And on deals they should be doing, them telling them that they should lean in. But we always, in all of our deals, with the exception of one where we're actually the super senior piece, we always want to own that control piece of that loan, whatever that is. And we're capped at 65% of value, but we always want to own that control piece, whether it's the bottom 10% or bottom 50%, we have to be in that control seat. And we're there again behind the curtains, where if that business plan changes, we're there to first help behind the curtain or coming out in front, keep it on the rails or get it back on the rails. But if it goes off the rails, we're there to jump in. We already have visibility. That debt fund isn't saying, oh, well, what do we do here? You know, should we sell this? Let's market it. and get caught in this quagmire. We're already there. And from our standpoint, the long-term greedy part of that is that if we're a good partner of those debt funds, and we're in a few deals with, you know, several of them, the other 90% of their portfolio, if anything ever becomes stressed or distressed, we're there, right? We're the first guys. Because every distress deal that we've done as a firm has not been publicly marketed. It's not been publicized. Lenders don't like telling the world, hey, we have a shitty loan on our balance sheet. It's usually done quietly. It's done through relationships. If it's an impaired position, they'll run a quiet process. But a lot of it is having that visibility or having those relationships. So for us, it's about how do we have that visibility before those loans even become non-performing. As soon as they become an issue, we're already there. We're top of mind. There's one other huge difference in the business today versus the paper that existed from GFC and before is that UCC pledge. Lenders learned a lot in the early days of GFC on how clogged the system can get and how quickly, where it would take 3 or 4 years to exercise a state level foreclosure. And you saw it on the residential side. People would just say, oh, well, screw it. It's going to take them 4 years to foreclose on me. I'll basically squat here and live for free. Borrowers did the same in commercial real estate. And so everyone got smarter in the sense of having that pledge of membership interest as an accelerated remedy, as a hammer. So every deal that we do, when we say we have the control piece, we have that remedy.
So even though you're not technically mezz, the borrower is getting a senior loan as part of that process. You're saying, hey, we're giving you a senior loan,
but we're also taking
a member pledge.
We always have the mezz pledge. So when you think of mezz or mezzanine debt in the traditional sense, you would think of it as, oh, it goes to 75 or 80% of the capital stack. That's changed. And under our structure, it's 65% of value. And we always have, or less, the average LTV in the portfolio right now is like 51. And we always have that mezz pledge because that is the hammer that you don't want to use, but it forces the borrower to sit with you, right? And when I say, hey, we've on the two loans we bought this year, we've had the borrowers in our offices in Florida and New York. And it's because they know that, hey, you're not going to be able to play that game. We can take over as owners in 120 days or less. In some states, it's 60 days. And we're just gonna boot you out. And then we can foreclose on ourselves at the state level if we needed to. But it's a hammer. It's a hammer that most lenders, especially lenders that aren't operators or developers, don't want to use or are uncomfortable using because you become the owner, for better or for worse. So if that owner did something toxic or disingenuous, you are now him.
And there's costs associated.
And there's costs and there's liability that needs to be assessed that goes with it. And there's ways of structuring around that to minimize that. But what's most importantly is not having to use the hammer, but having the hammer in the room and basically saying, this is like you guys, it prevents the gamesmanship that existed in the vintage paper. So it's, you know, we have this conversation all the time with investors in the fund in terms of duration and if when you buy a non-performing loan on duration, because we had non-performing loans in our early days that lasted 4.5 years, you know, state and playing the games, you know, appeal, then bankruptcy at the end and out of bankruptcy and into bankruptcy and just manipulating the system, where today, you know, we can actually say with conviction, hey, it's a condensed time frame because you have that hammer. Again, doesn't mean you're going to use it, but that borrower is going to have a different level of cooperation today than they did in 2008 or 2009.
Hanging on the performing side for a second, if your stated rate that you're lending a condo developer is, let's say, 10 or 12%, and you're kind of levering that up because you're taking the most risky piece, the control piece, what kind of return are you trying to target, assuming the loan stays performing?
So it depends on several factors. Number one, what we do day in and day out is we either don't like deals and it's a quick pass for, you know, sponsor, geography, asset class, capital stack, whatever. And on the real estate that we do like the story and the sponsorship, the ask is generally here, and we're going back and saying, we like the attachment point here. And we're structuring that based on the returns that we think are commensurate with that risk profile on that asset and that geography with that sponsor. Where we sit today with spreads being where they are on construction and some of the dislocation in capital markets, we're solving to a very high teens yield there through engineering that piece of the stack. Again, last dollar not going above 65% LTV, in most instances, well below that, to get to that high teens current yield. But again,
so you have a dual negotiation, because you're negotiating with the borrower if you're out front, but you're also negotiating with the lender who has the less riskier part of the stack to say, hey, you can only charge me this much because here's the return I'm trying to solve
for. So on deals that we're not sourcing and structuring and speaking for the whole loan ourselves, well, we could split that. Most of our deal flow comes from other debt funds. Day in and day out, we're seeing 3 to 5 deals a day from other debt funds. I think in Q3, we screened like 75 deals, wow. $7 billion of transactions. We committed to 3. So they are coming to us and saying, hey, we're either looking at this deal or we already signed a term sheet on this deal. Here's where the pricing is. And we're telling them, okay, yeah, you wrote it at SOFR 800. We'll take this percentage of the stack and we'll agree that you take this spread. So instead of you getting SOFR 8, you're going to get SOFR 7, SOFR 650. And we're going to take this piece. We're going to take the balance. So we're generally solving to a yield. They're calling us and saying, what yield do you need to solve to on this deal? So that's part of the structuring aspect. When we're out front sourcing or structuring our own deals, which again, is not the business plan, there's special situations where we are the right and best party in our view to be doing that out front versus someone else doing it. In Fund One, we actually prohibit ourselves from originating. And there's a couple situations where we sourced and structured the entirety of the deal and basically packaged it and had to lay it off to someone else. So in certain special sits, we believe we should be the one structuring. And in that instance, we're sourcing and speaking for the entirety of the loan. And then we're deciding where we get best execution, whether it's an A loan, a senior participation, and have those relationships in the capital markets to basically go get that execution, whether with repeat partners or other banks.
In your fund structure, when you have a performing loan position, the return is kind of capped. How do you structure a waterfall based on a capped return?
You're saying
for your investors,
for the fund?
Yeah.
So what's interesting, we learned a lot in Fund One. The origination piece and special situations was one of them. The other was that we had dual fee structures between performing and non-performing. And again, we were talking about, you know, how you comp people and there's not a one size fits all. We thought that was the right structure. And in hindsight, it just created confusion because mm-hmm. sometimes a non-performing loan becomes re-performing. Sometimes a performing loan becomes non-performing. Right. So in our fund, we have a two-pronged strategy, performing and non-performing. We've basically legislated that there's a cap in the fund on non-performing, because when you're buying non-performing loans, they are accruing. You are not getting paid. And if you're taking leverage on that, you have negative carry because you're paying for cost of capital. Now, you're accruing at a default rate. The stated default rate is typically 18 to 24%. And on a levered basis, if our cost of capital is 9, and we have even 1-to-1 leverage, we're accruing at 39% in that example. And a lot of these were accruing into the 40s, 50s, and even 60s.
Really?
On a levered basis, because there's so much equity in those positions. So the way the fund is set up is meant to modulate that, where you have 30% in non-performing as a cap, that when it's realized, as those get realized, are great pops and are multiples. And then the 70% of the book, which is performing, which is in the high teens, that when you take the 70% of that, you're still distributing on a quarterly basis, you know, a double digit annualized yield to your investors with kind of, you know, with regularity. So the way we guide investors in our structure is you know, the expectation today with where spreads are, we don't think they'll be there forever, is you should kind of expect a 10 to 12 on an annualized basis, and then the pops from those NPLs as they get realized. You know, we have an NPL we bought in April that if they paid us off tomorrow, it would be a 1.6 multiple to the fund. So those pops are what kind of get the total returns in the vehicle to the target, which is, you know, north of 20.
And what does your carry look like in the fund? Like, what's your promote?
So
generally,
depends. We have different share classes, but the regular LP share class is 1.5% management fee and a 20% promote over an 8% hurdle. So pretty market, pretty investor friendly from a fee standpoint. And then we also do co-investment through the fund where you know, we have concentration limits, and if you have more than 30% non-performing, you do that as a co-investment that gets offered to all the fund LPs first. But there's different share classes where bigger investors have fee breaks.
Do you have a catch up?
Do you have a catch up? Yeah, we do have a catch up above an 8.
That's really valuable. And not a lot of people think about how valuable a catch up could be in a deal where the returns might not be outsized.
Yeah. And look, coming from the equity business, right? You know, debt investing is different in terms of duration, in terms of bandwidth and resources, and in terms of returns, meaning if you're taking equity risk, you're supposed to be making, you know, significantly higher than debt returns. We just think we're in this asymmetric period where we're able to earn equity returns by being in senior debt. And again, it's set up as an all-weather vehicle where if there's not as much distress that we think is coming, we'll just keep doing more of the performing stuff, and that's fine. But where spreads are today, we're getting outsized returns. And again, it's an opportunity that we think is here for a while. But as spreads come in, you know, the return profile will shift again.
Let's kind of close and bring it home with the non-performing side, because that seems like a huge opportunity right now. Yeah. Everyone's talking about it. A lot of real estate investors that were typically GPs of their own deals are now trying to buy debt to take things over. How does that work? How do you buy a debt? Like, explain that whole process and what the strategy is. And maybe Terra Beachside is a good example of how that works in real life.
Yeah, it's, look, every non-performing loan that we've bought has had a different story or different set of circumstances. So first and foremost, if you're looking at it, we're always underwriting, whether performing or non-performing, we're underwriting as if we are going to own the real estate. And over 100 plus credit deals, never had a single dollar principal loss. So we hate losing more than we like winning, and always focus on downside protection. So is there enough equity to burn off? And goes back to the UCC item they were talking about before, which is when you're looking at buying a piece of distressed debt, you want to understand why the situation exists. Is it an asset issue? Is it a borrower issue? Is it just absentee ownership or capital issues elsewhere? How much equity is there to burn off based on where you're buying that loan? So people always say, oh, well, do you buy it at discounts? Do you buy it at par? We've had amazing success buying loans at par, where last dollar was at 50% of value. And we've had amazing success buying Terra Beachside at 30 cents on the dollar.
Wow.
Because the equity was significantly impaired. It's purely a factor of, at that moment in time and your outlook on the world, how much equity do you think exists? And how much equity do you need to exist at your attachment point to burn off? And then you're measuring it in time and you're wargaming and saying, okay, you know, what are the different scenarios here? Because when you buy a non-performing loan, the spectrum of opportunities over that duration are pretty narrow in terms of you're either going to get paid off, you're either going to have to take it all the way through litigation and get it to an auction, at which point someone may buy it at auction, you may take it back, or you may take it back yourself or come up with a restructuring and take possession and have to see the asset through and execute the business plan. So you're iterating all these different scenarios, and we run a lot of them, and none of them are ever, you know, exactly right. But the thought process is, okay, Are they a fighter? How long is this going to be? What protective advances are we going to have to make? And if this goes on for this period of time, when do we hit a valuation ceiling? When does our 60% or 65% LTV entry point hit 100, at which point it's dead money from that point on, meaning every day thereafter, we're not earning anymore if values haven't changed.
Right.
We're just stopped out at that point. And how do we strategize? So if there's a ton of equity to burn off, you may not be in such a urgent rush to try and, you know, navigate or work it out. Or if the borrower isn't engaging, you're not chasing them. If you think it's in a geography where, you know, that values might change or you have a view on the world, you might want to accelerate it. It might be a borrower issue that person is the only person you could get a deal done with, but they may not be in that seat 6 months from now. So all these things come into play. But when we're buying these non-performing loans, and again, distress investing is not a business plan. It is episodic. It is cyclical. Yeah. And we've bought loans throughout our history as a firm, but between 2012 and 2019, you know, it's like onesie twosies here and there. 2019, we bought a big one, went round trip on that in 7 months, but then that was it. And now we're seeing it, but it's not for the faint at heart. It's an art and a science. It requires a lot of strategy. It requires interacting with people that at first may not want to interact with you. And always first taking the approach of, hey, here's the situation. This situation exists, whether it's us or anyone else. How do we navigate this situation? How do you want to navigate this situation? And what's the desired outcome? And a lot of times you find out what's important to borrowers. It's not always money. It's optics. It's emotion. It's, hey, I realize I'm here, but I just can't have something in the press that I got foreclosed on. Is there a way? I know my equity is impaired. You know, is there a way we can do this cooperatively? Maybe I could get a hope note, you know, if the market outperforms and you guys do better. You know, it's just getting in the room, because as a in our seat, we're not a bank, right? We don't have this box that says, hey, it has to fit exactly here. We can be entrepreneurs, which is what we're best at as jockeys. So we can sit across the room and structure any deal that works for us and works for that borrower. And if it doesn't work, then the alternative is the litigation path, which sometimes just has to be the case. But it is the most fascinating part of the business, because every situation is different. Again, we're not in the widget business. It requires, and you get to utilize your brain a lot, which for us is exciting.
I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question, and that's, what's your favorite hotel?
Where?
Wherever. We actually bought so it was cool. We didn't talk about this on the podcast, but we did a deal together.
We did.
And it was our first opportunity, my company's first opportunity to buy a note. And we basically brought the deal to you because didn't really have the experience.
Way too quickly.
Our multiple was so weak. We didn't have an opportunity to negotiate anything, but that was on the Ace Brooklyn, which turned out to be a amazing performing loan and a really great hotel.
Yeah. And it's been a great success for those guys. What is my favorite hotel?
You can pick more than one if you want. Yeah. I mean, I've heard about all these race car trips you go on all around the world. So there's got to be one that you stopped in wow.
I've only been on a couple. You have. you've had Dev's been on a lot more of those than I. Actually, I only went because he invited me. My favorite hotel. That's a tough one, man. You know, when I think about New York and kind of like, you know, the history. You know, there's something special about being in the St. Regis and the Plaza. Most of the time, I mean, I'm not spending time in hotels. I'm dropping my stuff and running around like a maniac. I would say that one of the best experiences I had was when Mara and I were on our honeymoon in Capri. We ended our honeymoon in Capri and we stayed at La Scala Nutella. And I remember just everything was perfect. And we got there and we're sitting there having lunch. And it was like the waiters knew everyone. And the waiter came over and I said, you know, what's the story here? And he said, what do you mean? He says, is there a wedding or something? Everyone's, you know, he goes, no. These people come the same weeks every year. Like this is their, like we know everyone here. He's like, you're the only person here that we don't that we don't know. And it was just perfect. But I've been fortunate enough in my travels to experience and stay in a lot of amazing hotels, and plenty of hotels that I don't want to stay at ever again. But yeah, I'd have to say that those are top of mind. But that's a tough question.
Great.
What's your favorite hotel? And don't say one of your own.
No, it's not actually. And I think in my own career, I still haven't created my favorite hotel. There's still opportunity. I would say for family is Brush Creek Ranch in Wyoming. It's just like amazing for the kids, an amazing experience. And then Paris is my favorite city in the world. So the Ritz Hotel in Paris for just like opulence and history and transforming you to a different time and experience is high up there as well. They have a great swimming pool.
Awesome.
So those would be two of mine. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks
this
for
is
having
fun.
Me, buddy.
Hey everyone, it's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter @JWorzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Worzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.